Hello, everyone. I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from The Oldie. It could be said that my guest for this interview with Friends of The Oldie was not shy in coming forward. By his own admission, he enjoys writing about himself and laughs at all his own jokes. If I were to describe him, the word legend comes effortlessly to mind. A journalist of some renown, he joined the Sunday Times in 1960, starting work as the boy on the Atticus column, under the likes of John Buchan, Sir Cheverel Sitwell and Ian Fleming. Within 4 years, he took over, introducing readers to a younger, more eclectic and avant-garde mix of upcoming names that were to be the hallmark of the swinging 60s, ranging from gritty northern novelists to pop stars and fashion designers. A writer, broadcaster and raconteur of considerable renown, at 85 he has, to coin his own phrase, been at it for a long time. If longevity is a secret, industry must surely be the key, having written over 100 books on just about any subject, from the Beatles to biographies and even Love in a Biscuit Factory. He is, of course, Hunter Davies. Our conversation starts with the lights off. I hope you enjoy the programme.
They won't see me.
No.
They'll just hear me.
No, yes, exactly. But the better thing about that is they won't see me because you're good looking, I'm not. Now, I'm going to start off, Hunter, by saying I was just as we were opening up party to your telephone call and you said Davies as in Welsh. But actually, you don't come from Wales at all, do you?
The man I was talking to is a Welshman called Rhys. No, I'm not Welsh. I've got a Welsh surname, but I'm Scottish, born in Scotland. Parents are Scottish, grandparents are Scottish. But the family legend is that a Welsh soldier ran away from Waterloo and joined a Scottish regiment, and that's how we come to be Scottish. My wife hated me being called Davies. She hated being called Mr. Davies. She only wishes I'd be called McGregor or McDonald or a really good Scottish name. She thought Davies was so boring.
So where do we start? I can either start by saying many congratulations on two jabs Davies, or do I say happy birthday for your 85th birthday? Which do you want us to take the pick?
Actually, they're both an achievement. Getting two jabs, first of all, proves I'm alive.
Yes, congratulations. Hey.
Being 85 is also proof that I'm alive. But I got so much copy out of the two jabs. I've had two articles out of it so far.
I read. Can you just tell me, why was it that you got the two jabs straight away?
Because I'm a very vulnerable person. My best friend, Matt, he signs himself Matt all the time.
Yes.
I think it's Mr. Hancock to you. He's been sending me 2,000 word letters for a year now, saying you're extremely vulnerable. Don't leave the house. If you're ill, go to bed and die. And on no account, use the National Health Service. Bye-bye. That's roughly what the NHS has been telling me. And the reason is I've had a triple heart bypass. So I'm on lots of stupid drugs. I've had a knee transplant. I've had a hernia. I've got rheumatoid arthritis. But apart from that, I'm absolutely brilliant.
Aside all the fact that the clutch is going and perhaps you need a new fan belt, on the whole, what would you say is the secret of longevity? I mean, you have great energy, Hunter. I mean, what is it that keeps you going where everybody else, every other self-respecting 85-year-old listener of the Oldie podcast would otherwise be sat back in their chair with their slippers on watching daytime TV? What keeps you going?
Boredom. I would be, all my life, if I've had half an hour between projects, like one book finishing and another commission not coming in, I go absolutely spare. I'm desperate to work. So it's sort of mental energy, I suppose, and excitement and enthusiasm. And most of all, I've got a young girlfriend.
This is the lovely Claire.
That's right, who's 72. A young woman, 12 years younger than me.
What is the opposite of a cougar? Because that's what you are in male terms, isn't it, really?
I mean, she looks so much younger than me anyway. She looks about 59, but she's so glamorous and slim and stunning. I hope she's listening. She's not in the house at the moment. She's coming tomorrow. But people do think I'm her dad or her granddad. And it's funny, I've gone through life until I was roughly in my 70s, always been taken for much younger than I am. And I was always boasting about my age. Once I got to 80, I boasted the opposite. Don't you know who I am? That was my seat. I was talking first. Don't you know how old I am? Yes, I will have another glass. Don't you know how old I am? So I boast about it all the time.
If you think that the lovely Claire is 59, how old do you think you are then at 85? What is 85 is the new what?
I'm 85. I look in the mirror. I was 85 last week. And I looked in the mirror. I thought, you don't look a day over 84. So I know I don't look like Cliff Richard. I haven't got the hair of Melvin Bragg. I don't look like Harry Grealish. He's a footballer. Mm-hmm. He is yummy. I think I look my age, but I like to think I don't act my age. And when I'm with people and rushing around and interviewing and talking to them and walking on the heath and going to parties and social life and having social intercourse, I don't think I feel 85. And I like to think it might be actual fantasy, but people don't take me for 85. So when I hear myself talking these days, I do seem to have suddenly acquired an older voice. I remember listening to a great friend of mine, Harry Evans, who used to be the editor of the Sunday Times.
The great Harry Evans.
Yeah. The great Harry Evans. And he was at the same college as me, but he's 8 years older than me, and he just died a couple of months ago. Mm. And he was a great broadcaster, so fluent, and he still had his lovely, his very charming Lancashire accent. And the last few years, listening to him on the radio or the telephone, I suddenly thought, even though he's speaking fluently, it's an old voice. Now, my theory is, for some reason, men's voices do age when they get old, more than women's voices. If you listen to Joan Bakewell, you can't tell. She's much older than me. She's a dear friend of mine. She's 87, 88. Yes. And her voice is not really aged. There's a PhD there, Harry.
Okay, all right. I never went to university, so I'll pass on that one. But do you think, and you talk about Harold Evans's wonderful Lancashire accent, the advantage, is there an advantage, do you think, in having a mature accent, so we say? Do you think it gives you added gravitas to what you write about?
No, because you don't write with your voice, you write with... I used to be a broadcaster. Amazingly enough, from 3 years back in the... I can't remember, the last century. 3 years in the 1980s, I did a radio programme on Radio 4 every week for 3 years called Bookshelf. And that was... I took over from a very lovely man called Frank Delaney, who had a beautiful voice. And I was suddenly asked if I wanted to do the programme. I was so amazed because I've gone through life. When I first tried to get a holiday job in Carlisle when I was a student, and I was editor of the local student paper, and I tried to get a holiday job on the Cumberland News, the editor there said, "No, you'll never make us a journalist. You speak too quickly and you mumble." And for about 40 years, I believed that. I believed I better stick to mumbling and interviewing people. And there I was for 3 years. I'm the Lifluth Radio 4 presenter. But it was too much like hard work. Writing's the easy work because I only have one topic.
What is that?
Me.
What is it about writing that you enjoy so much?
Amusing myself. I laugh at all my jokes. My wife used to say, there's a certain silence from me, and that certain silence always meant I was reading my own stuff. You could tell by the silence what I must be doing. No, I'm just trying to amuse myself. I'm trying to get the readers in journalism at the top of the page to the bottom. I'm trying, and in books, it's the same. I'm trying to get people from the first chapter to the last chapter. In my journalism, all I do these days is write about me. I do a money column in the Sunday Times, and I do quite a bit for the Oldie, but that's just about me. I do the New Statesman, and that's on football. I've done that for 24 years, but that's really about me being a football fan. And I do two other things as well. But most of my active journalistic career, I was an interviewer. I did for 20, 30 years, so-called famous people and celebrities. And I gave that up in the end because it was such hard work. You don't get the backup anymore. And you've got to find these people on your own. And you've got to track them down. Whereas I can do 1,000 words in an hour sitting here on my own. Whereas going around the world to interview somebody takes forever.
What is it, do you think, about Hunter Davis, which is so interesting to everybody else? What is it that, it is obviously your style of journalism, I don't mean that comes across slightly crassly. What I mean is what is it that again, like all of us who write, I suppose, that puts you apart, that makes people say, that's Hunter Davis, I want to read his column because I enjoy it.
First of all, it's longevity. I've been at it for a long time. And therefore, when I see people, let's say, 50 plus, and I find out they're a newspaper reader, the chances are they have read something I have written because I've been so prolific and still let you think I am. People under 30, they've never read my stuff because they don't read books. I know I don't do any social media, but I did a column on the Sunday Times and they're always telling me the feedback's not very good. They think you're showing off. They think you're a sexist pig. There's too much sex in your column. I'll say, am I bothered? Am I heckless? So I never read it. But I know I'm probably an acquired taste. And I have stylistic styles, which I've had all my life. And my wife used to say, oh, you're just being silly again. Stop all the smart. You think you're being witty and funny and clever. I said, I am. But you don't realize when you're taking the piss out of people, they do get hurt. You think you're being infectious. So I know there's probably lots of people that think, oh God, not him again. And it's also true that I have a theory that readers' memory lasts 5 years and then you can repeat everything. And I've repeated everything 20 times.
What I admire about you is as much not only for your industry, but also your I mean, you make light of your writing about yourself, but you've written some very impressive biographies of other people, namely Gazza, Wayne Rooney, John Prescott. Writing about other people using their voice must be very hard.
Yeah, that was I had a long spell doing that. But most of my I've had 100 books published. Are you listening, Harry?
Yeah, I'm listening. I'm all there. I've only had two.
It's only in the last few years I've done 3 books of memoirs. But until then, I didn't really write about myself. I was doing books about comprehensive school, walking, football, I can't remember all the other ones.
Yeah.
And
the
I
Beatles,
did Ghost
the Beatles,
Biography.
The Beatles.
Yeah, the Beatles.
That was
the Beatles. It wasn't. It was in the third person by me. It wasn't ghosted, but it was really their only official biography they ever gave anybody access to. But I wasn't in it. And Ghosting Gazza, I did Wayne Rooney, and that was a terrible failure.
Mm-hmm.
That was awful. I did him because I was asked. I did him when he was just 19 and just begun at Man United. It's obviously a very intelligent, nice person. Never let me down. I was very fluent. But he was too young and not reflective. Whereas I did Gazza when he was semi-retired, and he was at the end of his career, and Gazza will tell you everything.
Yeah.
Everything. Mm. Half the time I said, oh, Gazza, that's disgusting. That's all. I can't tell you the stories I didn't use. That's appalling. We can't put. So catching his voice without being condescending, without having him, his Geordie accent coming out. But the biggest thing, of course, is shaping it so you want to read on. Yeah, I've stopped doing ghosted biographies. I don't know why. I've done enough footballers.
But Gazza, as an example, lived through the excesses of the 80s and 90s. I remember stories of him being propped up on the bar with Chris Evans on the Pont de la Tour and stuff like that. And he was at the top of it. You lived through the height of the 60s with the Beatles, Fleet Street at its very most powerful. Great photographers like Don McCullen, the Sunday Times, the Sunday papers were the news. What was it like being in Fleet Street at that time? It must have been magical.
When I began, I joined the Sunday Times in 1960, and I felt very out of it because everybody seemed to have been at public school and president of the Oxford Union, and everybody seemed so much better educated and more and smoother than me. And I was the boy on the Atticus column, and we had to do really boring. It's a very long, distinguished column, Atticus, still going, but totally different. But Ian Fleming used to do it, John Buchan and Sir Cheverell Sitwell. But we did boring things like, who will be the next Archbishop of Canterbury? Who will be the next ambassador in Washington? As if I care. The 60s didn't really begin until about 1964. And that's when I took the column over, and I began specialising in the people I was personally interested in, which was the gritty northern novelists and pop stars like the Beatles and fashion designers and pop stars. And that became, those are my interests anyway, but that became the flavour of the 60s. So it was a brilliant time. And it was, you felt that what was lovely was that it didn't matter where you came from. It didn't matter what your accent was. If you were vaguely artistic and vaguely could sing or vaguely could, if you remember after the war, the 1950s, all actors had to speak the Queen's English. You see these films now from the 1950s, and all these actresses you never heard of are so posh, you weren't allowed to speak unless you were a dustman in the Northern accent. So the 60s were very exciting, and I enjoyed it. And I feel so sorry for the poor sods today, the journalists today. They never leave the office. They never go and meet people. They're lifting handouts all the time. They don't have a 3-minute lunch, never mind a 3-hour lunch. We had 3-hour lunches and we had massive expenses. And it was, I was grossly overstaffed. The excesses were appalling. But when I joined the Sunday Times in 1960, there was only the Observer. There was no Sunday Telegraph. There was no Mail on Sunday. So if my name was in Sunday Times, which it wasn't for 5 years, because it was anonymous, but when I started having stuff in the paper, on a Monday morning, almost everybody I met who was semi-literate had read what I had done. Now, there are so many papers, so many magazines, and of course, so little work. It's all spread out all over the place. So it was a brilliant time. Lucky me.
Lucky you indeed. If we think of the swinging 60s, what were the key icons for you? Five key icons, you say, that was the swinging 60s for me.
Well, obviously the Beatles. That's the number one. Because the Beatles weren't just a pop group. They affected fashion. People copied their clothes. People copied their hair. Most of all, forget their brilliant songs, they sang their songs in their own accent. In the 50s, when I was growing up, English pop stars tried to sing in a mid-Atlantic accent. They put on what they thought was a transatlantic accent, and they wore silk suits and said, "You're a lovely audience. I love you. Kiss, kiss, kiss." Now, the Beatles were, well, those, well, the early days, Brian Epstein cleaned them up, but they were themselves, and they were smoking on stage and chewing gum and swearing and being rude. And but most of all, you could hear the Liverpool accent coming through. Unless they were doing songs like Twist and Shout, which is an American accent. Their attitude was such, they really felt that anybody from anywhere could do anything. That was the whole thing about the Apple idea, the Apple company. It was to give everybody a chance. And also, there were, when you came to London from the provinces in those days, people did tend to, back to Joan Bakewell, for example, or they tended to change their accent and become BBC English, which the Beatles didn't really do. I suppose Mary Quant, she was an icon.
Yes, yeah.
And I say all the obvious ones. One of my people that I really admired and thought was brilliant was an artist, an art director called Alan Aldrich. Alan Aldrich, he became art director of Penguin Books, which is an amazing posh job. The people who are art directors, as you know from your publishing history, have gone to very smart art colleges, the Royal College of Art, and up their own bums all the time. But Alan never went to art college, and he used to talk about drawing as if it had an R in the middle. He always said, "Drawing, I've got to do a drawing." And he was so clever, and his style of paintings was so good. So he, to me, was an icon. Did I mention Vidal Sassoon?
No, but you are now.
Yeah. And I suppose David Hockney. I'm just thinking of the 60s.
Yeah.
David Hockney. I once went to interview David Hockney. And he was just won a gold medal at the Royal College. And I went to his flat. And he'd just come back from America with a boyfriend. And in America, he's on a scholarship. They were watching late night television. And on American television, there was an advert for hair dye. And the slogan was, "Blondes have more fun." So him and his friends went out in the middle of the night and had their hair dyed blonde just to have more fun. I thought it was so funny. I went to his laboratory, and on his wall, he had a photograph of Dennis Law. Dennis Law was a very famous footballer who played for Man United in Scotland. And I came back and I said, "Hey, David, I didn't realise you're a football fan." He said, "I'm not a football fan." I said, "Well, that big poster you stuck up at the laboratory of Dennis Law, oh, I just like his thighs." I didn't use that in 1960, whenever it was, 63, 64, because it was suggested he was gay, which of course he was.
Yeah.
But in those days, it was against the law. So I put David Hockney.
Yeah. The 60s, this almost devil-may-care attitude to life. What do you think brought that about, that sod you, I'm going to do it anyway attitude, which of course is very refreshing? What was it?
Well, it was it was boundaries. Suddenly in the 60s, the boundaries were down. You didn't have to have a certain sort of education. You didn't have to have a certain sort of accent. You didn't have to have been trained. If you could do the job, it didn't really matter. Whereas in the post-war years, it was a bit because of the influence of the war and a stratified society and the officer class and the other classes. People were brought up to be law abiding and to do what they're told. You revered the police, you revered all these people in authority. That was breaking down by the 60s and people could do anything. That was the feeling. That feeling was definitely in the air.
If there was a gatekeeper who let the gate open, who was someone of that society, of the early 50s, the late 40s, who said, you know what, we need to get these accents back in, get the richness of the country back in the game. Who do you think that was?
But it's not true. People who weren't there think, oh, they're all sleeping around and taking drugs. From my experience, it was really the 70s when that happened, when ordinary people from back and beyond were taking drugs and sleeping around. In the 60s in London, I never took drugs. I didn't sleep with anybody until I slept with my wife, while she was married to me. I did take drugs once. I was with the Beatles, and Ringo, after a session, gave me a reefer, because I said I've no ooh. And I took it home, and I tell my wife, look at Ringo's given me a reefer. So that evening, after we'd done our 10 hours work down the word mine, we put the telephone off the hook and we closed the curtains and we lit up. Neither of us never smoked in our lives, so it didn't quite know how. And we took a few puffs. Nothing happened. We put the phone back on the hook and we opened the curtains. Next time I saw Ringo, I said, didn't think much of your reefer. He said it was cabbage leaves. So I don't know, but I did by chance get high. The Beatles had a very, very nice, clever, witty PR. He's dead now, called Derek Taylor. He was their great friend. And when they were in Savile Row, that was their office, I once went to have lunch with Derek one day. And I picked him up in his office in Savile Row. And I was sitting out waiting for him to get ready. And he said, oh, it's my birthday. Would you like a piece of my birthday cake? I said, oh, yeah, lovely. And they had lots of Sloaney girls. They had a kitchen there. And he said to one of the girls, is that cake ready in the oven yet? And she came in with the cake. It was a sort of gingery cake. And guess what's coming, can't you?
Yeah.
And I had two slices. I thought it was delicious. And over lunch, I started laughing and giggling, and it was a hash cake. That's my only inadvertent experience of taking drugs.
I was going to ask if you felt there was someone who was the most influential in perhaps unlocking the doors of the 1960s. Who do you think that was?
You mean for me or for...
The person from society who was that man in the 1940s who suddenly said, let's have Davis in.
There wasn't really one person who created the 60s. There wasn't one person who said, now let's all do this. In my particular life, Harry Evans, whom I mentioned earlier, he was a great role model for me. And I left full-time journalism in 1968 when my Beatles book came out. I realised I could work full-time from now on at home doing books. But Harry persuaded me, because he was the editor, to come back for 6 months every year and help him do certain jobs. So I was the women's editor at one time, and I had Molly Parkin and Jilly Cooper and lots of other lovely girls. And it was the lunches were. It was the best fun I've ever had as a journalist, editing the women's pages, since I was a student journalist. And then in the 70s, I came back and I edited the Colour magazine for Harry. And I had Tony Snowden and Don McCullen as the photographers.
Great photographers,
But I didn't really like it because I'm not really a visual person. And the art department hated me because I was trying to get more words in and fewer pictures. So I did that for 2 years. So it's nice to have done it. Because there's part of me, even though I'm a writing hack, there's part of me that quite like from time to time being a gaffer, being a boss. And it's a strange thing that happens when you're an editor, even though for section, even though the best fun in journalism is writing stuff and seeing your name in the paper, there is a secondary hidden fun, which is thinking of an idea, thinking of who's going to do it, and knocking it into shape and put it into the pages, even though nobody knows it was your idea. The satisfaction of sitting back and thinking, that was my idea, that's come off. And I didn't realise that was a pleasure. It's nothing like doing it yourself, but it's an enjoyment.
You are talking about being the gaffer, and about being there for the writer. You just told me you have a new commission. Can you tell us a bit about the new commission?
I've got two books coming out this year. The year is 2021. They're both similar sort of topics. There's one got put back for 2 years because of the COVID and lockdown. One is out in April, and it's a walk around the London parks. It's a book about the London parks. It's become more and more topical because they are our lifeblood today. Everywhere, parks are bulging because it's our only escape out of the house and to exercise and back to nature. So I've done 10 different parks in London, and I've interviewed people I meet, and it's personal, and I've interviewed the parkies. I've done the superintendent in every park, and I've been to their office. I've seen where they hide, because superintendents in parks, you never know where they're... There's a front office, but you don't know where the boss is. You don't know where he's crouching. Then I've done a whole book on just one park, which is Hampstead Heath, and that's out at the end of the year. I've done a year, I did it last year. So halfway through, COVID happens. It's a year in the life of the Heath. It's a personal book about me and the Heath. And I've just signed a commission. I'd be going mad because my regular publishers turned it down. I was furious. My girlfriend and I, we've acquired a love nest in the Isle of Wight. I'm very embarrassed about that because the Lake District is my natural home. And we had a house there for 30 years. And when my wife died, I kept it for a year, but I couldn't bear to live there on my own. So this is going off to a new place. I didn't know the Isle of Wight. And a new life. And my girlfriend. So I wanted to do a book about a year on the Isle of Wight. You know all those books at one time, like A Year in Provence, and Walking Lemons and Escape to Tuscany. That's not going to happen anymore. British people will not be fleeing to Tuscany and buying houses. They'll be fleeing to Wales or Scotland or Cornwall. Cornwall's full. They'll be going there. The Cotswolds are full and Devon's full. So I thought it was such a brilliant idea, but they all said, oh, no, the Isle of Wight. Sales and marketing says there's no books get sold in the Isle of Wight. Do another Lake District book, and we'll commission it at once. Mm. And I said, no, I can't repeat the Lake District. I want to do something. Anyway, I just signed the contract. So I'm working on that, and that's for next year. The background is the Isle of Wight, but it's love in old age. It's about having a girlfriend at my age.
Now, I want to talk about parties, Hunter. Claire, I know, is a great host of your lunches. What is the secret? What is the secret to the best long lunch?
Filling the glass up long before it's empty. She gets people absolutely sozzled.
You talk about walking. You have written a biography, perhaps one of Britain's greatest walkers, Alfred Wainwright.
I've got three heroes in life, three people in my lifetime I've adored and wanted to be like them and wanted to do what they did. And the three people were, one, Paul McCartney, because music just flows out of him and he's so hardworking. He'll be 80 next year and he's still knocking himself out. Alfred Wainwright, I thought his idea of those pictorial guides and how he wrote them and how he did them and how he spent 13 years doing them. And my other hero was Glenn Hoddle, who played for Spurs.
Absolutely.
And he was such a beautiful player. I used to go early to see him warm me up because he seemed so attractive and so supple and so skillful. And so, anyway, those are my three heroes. And they still are, in a way.
Do you have any latter-day heroes now or today that you could...
I do in football. I'm a Spurs supporter, except I don't like Mourinho. He's driving me mad. I'll be pleased when he goes because it'll end in tears and it'll go soon. I think he was so unkind when he was at Chelsea. Horrible to the Chelsea doctor. And he blames everybody except himself. Obviously, I adore Harry Kane and Son. But I'm a great fan of Jack Grealish, who plays for Aston Villa. Mm-hmm. I think he should be a definite regular in the England team.
You, of course, I think I'm right in saying, when it comes to international football, support Scotland. What do you think about England's hope for the next World Cup?
Rubbish. No, no chance. I was there in 66. And I've still got my ticket. And we actually came away from that game thinking, that's it. We'll be in the finals every year. We'll probably win it every few years. Of course, we've never been near it since. But we have good young players coming in every year, but they never seem to become a team. They never seem to do well at competitions. We've been to the semis, so I've lost all hope of England winning the World Cup ever again.
Well, I think, Hunter, I'm going to say thank you so much for appearing on the podcast. And I hope you have a lovely day tomorrow when Claire turns up to see you.
Thanks, Harry.
And that was all we have time for. With my thanks to Hunter Davis for being my guest, his new book, London Parks, an essential companion for anyone wishing to explore the evergreen beauty of Britain's capital city, is published by Simon & Schuster on the 29th of April, price £16.99. And talking of the capital city, don't give up hope on the old place yet, because just as soon as we can, that gastronomic highlight of the monthly calendar, the Oldie Lunch, will be making its long overdue comeback. Until then, keep the faith with the Oldie Podcasts, and if you enjoy them, why not tell a friend? And if you really enjoy them, why not visit theoldie.co.uk and hit the red square button top right marked subscription. And in the unfriendliest sounding but best meant farewell, from me, Harry Bucknell, locked down, locked away and locked up here in Dorset, remember, keep your distance, wash your hands, open the windows, and thank you for listening. Editing by Michael Stiliani, this has been a Gamekeeper production for The Oldie.